from KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Despite the widespread use of the word awesome, Bay Area psychologist and author Kirk Schneider believes we live in an awe-depleted age. In his most recent book, Awakening to Awe, he provides a map for how awe can transform lives. The editor of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology, he'll join us for the hour ahead in studios. We discuss awe and personal transformation, and we'll include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Bay Area author and psychologist Kirk Schneider joins us in studio for this forum hour, the author of 8 books and current editor of the Journal of Humanistic Psychology. Kirk Schneider is also vice president of the Existential Humanistic Institute and an adjunct faculty member of Saybrook Graduate School. His most recent book is Awakening to Awe, Personal Stories of Profound Transformation, and he's with us here in studio. Good to see you. Welcome.
It's great to see you, Michael. Thank you.
Well, let's get to the sort of definitions first of all, because we hear that word awesome so much, it's ad nauseum and shock and awe and so forth. You're really talking about wonder and mystery and all the things that awe in ancient times go back to, really.
I'm talking about an essential embrace of the cosmic mystery that we are shrouded in. Today a lot of the young folks emphasize awe in terms of the thrilling side. When they talk about awe, it's usually something, very exuberant and exciting and visceral.
Which is awe, too.
That is a piece of awe. Yeah. But awe, as you say, has shifted throughout the centuries. In olden times, awe was really equated more with dread and with a kind of trembling before the majesty and the tremendum of nature, which
or
eventually
God.
Got equated with God.
Yeah.
But really what I'm talking about, Michael, is radical openness to radical mystery or the humility and wonder or sense of adventure about life and all creation. If I can just give you a quick example right here. for everyone listening, now, on the face of it, we're just having an ordinary conversation. Pretty extraordinary to be here on KQED, granted. But from one angle, an ordinary conversation in an ordinary building in the city, and we're, in essence, sort of, flapping our lips. But is that really all that's going on? I mean, I would like to question everybody who's listening here to think about what is the ordinary or routine situation really about when looked at from a larger perspective. No, we're not just sitting here having an ordinary conversation, flapping our lips. We are sitting on a floor which rests on a gigantic ball that is whirling around the sun at 67,000 miles per hour, that is nested in a unit, that is nested in a galaxy, that is hurtling into the blackness of space and time at about 1.3 million miles an hour. Now, how many of us take the time to really absorb that sense, that realization?
But you could absorb it to the extent where it could almost be paralyzing. I mean, it's just so staggering. The imagination can't really embrace it even.
Well, this is the great question. Is it going to be paralyzing or is it going to be fascinating and exhilarating and life-affirming? Now, awe is a beautiful term in my view because it's one of the few transcendental terms that embraces the paradoxes of existence. The notion that we are both food for worms, in effect, and also soaring angels. And So it to me, it sort of embraces the whole of life and our kind of whole-bodied experience of the mystery of our being.
Yeah, you're talking about life affirmation and a sense of almost, cosmic consciousness or something approximating that and an awareness of our beings. But for the most part, we get dragged down into the mundane, into the quotidian, into this ordinariness that you talk about. I mean, for example, you write about awakening, like awakening to life and awakening to this mystery. Yeah. There are people who awaken in the morning and they can't get up out of bed. You know, they have to drag themselves. They get feeling depressed and the onus of life and all of that.
Absolutely. And that's why I call it radical openness to radical mystery. It does often take a kind of jolt or a shaking or even, unfortunately, in our culture, a crisis to sort of move people out of those routines and that familiar pattern of living, something to shake us. And hopefully, in that realization, in that awakening, we can develop a presence, develop a kind of centeredness about the larger picture, about the more of who we are. And that takes a lot of work. And that's one of the points I want to make here, too, is that this is not just a peak experience or a passing fancy sort of thing. For me, this is really about a lifetime cultivation.
How much of that cultivation is cognitive and how much of it is visceral or emotional?
I think it's all
both?
A piece. I call it a whole-bodied experience of life and of being.
So when you connect awe to everyday life, you awaken to the mysteries of life? You awaken to the sometimes impenetrable nature of those mysteries?
Well, first of all, you go beyond the quick fix model for living, which we are just immersed in. We're bathed in quick fixes all over, from drugs to our diets, often junk food, to our cell phones, text messaging, video preoccupations, and so on.
But you're not talking necessarily just back to nature. All those things come into play in our lives and certainly remain integral to our lives.
They do. They're all a part of our life experience. But my point is somehow helping us to break open to the more of who we are and the more of what's going on, as I was saying before. In another sense, I see awe as our ultimate partner. We're all going to end up in the embrace of what you might call the humility and wonder and the thrill and anxiety of the mystery of life. We're all going to end up in that void, in that mystery. And we might as well learn to connect with it, to dance with it now. And not only as a kind of a might as well, I think it would really help to enlarge and deepen and enrich our lives.
This is personal and interpersonal both, I presume, isn't it?
Yes, it can be both personal and interpersonal.
And it leads, in your judgment, I mean, this is essentially at the heart of your book, can lead to profound transformation. But that's personal transformation, or is it also interpersonal transformation?
Well, it can be interpersonal as well. This is a key point. Awe can be tremendously healing, and it can be healing both for the individual or for relationships or even the society at large, because it takes us out of, again, the petty identifications, the bogging down, the routine living that we're so often ensconced in. And it points to, as I was saying, this vastness that we're surrounded by, the realization, the excitement, the whole-bodied fulfillment. of being attuned to the larger picture of life.
This is what we call ontological thinking in many ways, that is thinking about our being.
Being, and, yeah. Absolutely. And I do have some concrete ideas about
how we can
do this.
Yeah, I want to get to those. But you know, most of our lives are quiet desperation, like Thoreau said. Most of our lives are pretty mired in mundanity and banal things, trivial things for the most part. I mean, we'd like to be stimulated, and we can stimulate ourselves. But the fact of the matter is that, let's talk about it. I mean, what kind of techniques, what kind of psychological methods to, because a lot of this is attitudinal.
A lot of it's attitudinal. Well, I discovered through studying the experience of awe, both in myself and through the stories, these wonderful stories of interviewees in my book. By the way, a number of them are from the Bay Area. And I really hope that somebody will do a story on their radical transformations. For example, with Jim Hernandez, from being a gang member to being a gang mediator and a youth advocate, or Michael Cooper going from the dregs of drug addiction to now a yoga instructor and very respected counselor in the Tenderloin.
Then you've got somebody else in a three-stage cancer, too.
Yes, Mark Stern in three-stage cancer. There's a couple of women in the book who suffered severe childhood abuse or abusive situations, who made tremendous transformations by cultivating this sense of awe, as well as students who are taking classes in service learning. Julia van der Rijn at Dominican College has been sort of exuding addressing this notion in students' learning process in the community, the service learning.
So how do you get into it, so to speak?
Yeah. So the several of the tools, or what I call lenses of awe, that came out of this study were, first of all, the lens of transience. And what I mean by that is that people in the study were able to attune to the passing nature of time and life. So you think about that right now. For example, you and me just sitting here. And again, we could just, you know, dwell on the routine aspects of that. But we could also zoom in to the very reality that our time is passing, is vanishing.
To be
rapidly
within the now and all of that.
That's right.
We could also
appreciate the moment.
Feel transient sometimes. And I'm a great enthusiast of Albert Camus, and he said, think of what your life might mean 5,000 years from now, and that's eternal nothingness. He calls that eternal nothingness. In other words, you can be engulfed by the sense of nothingness because of the transience of time and ephemera, too.
Well, that's a real question as to whether it's nothingness or even what nothingness is. I prefer the term enchanted agnosticism, because at least for me, it's rather uplifting and energizing to contemplate the vast unknown.
It's elevating.
It's elevating, yes, because we don't know, and I sort of love that uncertainty. That takes a long time to get to. But so
a lot of cultivating sometimes.
A lot of cultivating. I'm not sure it's just absurd, you know, or nihilistic, which some existentialists lean toward. And by the way, I think Camus is more open to the awe-based than somebody like Sartre. But I don't know if you want me to go on with the other lenses.
Yeah, please.
So, so being aware of the passing nature of time, the lens of transience, and the poignancy of that, the appreciation of the moment, the lens of unknowing and surprise. How many times do we step back and connect with an openness to what is unfolding before us in the here and now? For example, if we could turn our attention to that right now, the thrill or the excitement of what may evolve, what may happen here between us in this conversation and with our audience. To me, there is something very stimulating about that. So that unknowing, the lens of unknowing, and then the lens of surprise, the openness to being jarred or jolted a little bit, that something just out of the blue could happen, and especially if we're open to it. I don't know about you, but I've been to a number of those parties where it's just the last thing in the world where you're going to be with a group of people that you anticipate the same old conversations and the same old mannerisms and routine. But I very consciously now try to put myself or put on the lens of surprise and unknowing when I'm in those situations.
This openness also kind of gets us to a notion. I know you're a humanistic psychologist by training, and we're somewhat of an acolyte of Rollo Mays, whom we both admired a great deal.
Yes.
But there's a bit of the Gestalt psychology in this too, that is being within the here and now.
Yes. By Gestalt psychology, are you referring to the emphasis on the here and now, or the figure-ground relationship?
No, more the emphasis on the here and now, yeah.
Yeah, very much. That's certainly a flavor from Gestalt psychology, but I identify it even more with existential psychotherapy and psychology.
What you're talking about, living in the moment, defining ourselves, being open to mystery, to surprise, all these lenses that you speak of, this is something you feel quite optimistically is reemerging in our culture. Why?
Well, I do sense that people have sort of burned out with much of the, as I say, the quick fix model for living that we've been anchored down with, both in terms of what's been happening on the economic scene, people making these fast and loose deals and investments and actually ending up dragging a good part of the country and our economy down because of that. So there's a disillusionment about that. It's a disillusionment about our position, our role vis-a-vis the greater world, and can we really be these these policemen and these, you could say, sort of imperial-like leaders in the world, that really, realistically, has not been working very well when you look at the wars and the fallout from that. The efficiency model for living, people having to be sort of good cogs in the wheel, in the system. The lack of meaning that comes out of that in your day-to-day work lives often, as well as home lives. I do think there's a kind of ennui, there's a hollowness that contemporary world brings.
A shift because of that ennui and hollowness that you're sensing or you're...
I am sensing. I'm hoping, and I am sensing some of that. I think there was an indication of that with the election of Barack Obama. I think he represented more of that larger picture sense of life, a richer embrace.
And now the polls
lives.
Are telling us all that disillusionment has started to set in, as one could expect often when one... I mean, there's really one of the problems with inflating oneself with awe or buoying oneself up with awe, because one can be, of course, intensely disappointed because expectations often follow with that inflation.
Well, you call it inflation, and I agree that that is a danger, that's a dark side. If awe is distorted... I think at its deepest level, awe again is not about just the sweetness and light. It is about the fuller ranges of our experience of life, meaning that it very much embraces our anxious and apprehensive sides, as well as our abilities to venture out and transcend and enlarge our world. It celebrates the whole thing, is my point. And, you know, we're not going to find that in one particular leader or one particular thing. I think ultimately, as I was saying, it's our ultimate partner. Ultimately, we find that more in the place that religious people have pointed to, which some would call God. I would prefer the term awe or enchanted agnosticism.
You don't need God. You don't need religion for this, really, for what you're calling God.
I don't think you need the label God. I think that can actually handicap us, because this is a God beyond God, as Paul Tillich put it. This is beyond any lover, leader, icon, social conditioning, or even definable, specifiable deity. Because as soon as you've identified it, you've lost it in a sense. You've constricted it. This is about the vast enigma that is our situation, that is our canopy, if you will.
No, that is the human condition. And since bring up Tillich and God beyond God, it makes a good deal of sense existentially, because I think, you know, it's the idea of, again, the destination becomes the journey and the journey becomes the destination. And what we are about, really, most of all, is questioning. So that maybe there's even a veneration for just the idea of inquiry and the process of discovery through questioning, wherever it may lead.
There's very much a veneration for inquiry here. But again, it's not just intellectual. It's more of a, you know, really this notion comes down to a kind of feeling or sensibility. And that's partly what makes it hard to describe, certainly in linear terms. It's just more of a feeling about life. And if we can open ourselves, or if we can find people or situations that help us to open, we will experience this greater feeling.
This goes back to humanistic psychology, really, doesn't it? I mean, I was reading up on humanistic psychology the other day, and there was somebody who was trying to quantify it by saying growth and potential for self-actualization as opposed to behaviorism, as opposed to psychoanalysis. In other words, between those two extremes, there was the idea that humans can essentially develop and develop the human, well, individual as well as humankind.
Yeah, it very much harkens back to the early ideas of humanistic psychology, which were attempting to legitimate the larger ranges of our experience, of our thought, feelings, and sensations, and the bigger picture of living. Now, Maslow talked very specifically about peak experience, and this is close to that notion. But again, I don't see this as just a peak. I really see this as a lifetime cultivation to absorb the full richness that it offers.
And maybe slow down somewhat, especially the pace of our lives. Smell the roses, as the old cliche would have it.
Slowing down, absolutely. We didn't finish the lenses, but I don't know if
that would
it reminds
be a good
me
lens,
of another lens. Well, the lens of intricacy. The lens of the attunement to the hidden and the subtle nature of life, the details. So on your walk, for example, noticing the leaves or the trees.
Or the sky or the ground or whatever's around you. Let me invite listeners to join in. This is a discussion about awe with Kirk J. Schneider, whose book is Awakening Awe. What do you think? What do you want to ask? Join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, that toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also email forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Kirk Schneider, who is a Bay Area psychologist and author. His new book is Awakening to Awe, Personal Stories of Profound Transformation. In the book, there are indeed narratives about people who have transformed their lives by making themselves more open to humility and wonder, which is really what awe is all about. And we're talking to him about, well, how you can look through different lenses and mediate perhaps to gain that kind of ground. We're talking about literally a higher ground here. The question perhaps to listeners is, have you experienced awe, and what were the circumstances, and Did you do something intentional to bring it about? Kirk Snyder, again, is part-time faculty member of Saybrook Graduate School and vice president of the Existential Humanistic Institute. And he'll be at Book Passage. And you can actually meet him there on February 6th.
And contributors.
Corte Madeira. And some of the contributors will be with him. You can also go to his website, which is Kirk J. Schneider. That's S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R, kirkjschneider.com. And we're going to go to your calls here forthwith. You can also, by the way, join the conversation online by visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Before I bring in callers and emailers, though, go back to something else. We were talking before about the humanistic psychology, and you mentioned Maslow, and we mentioned Rollo May and so forth. Remember, there was a kind of a debate with you and Ken Wilber back in the 80s. Ken Wilber is someone who many people, of course, have been influenced by and continue to hold in awe, really.
Yes.
And it was the idea of sort of the transpersonal versus the existential. That is, on the one hand, the idea of freedom and happiness and existentially needing coercion, needing maybe misery to understand coercion, to understand freedom, misery to understand happiness, as opposed to a kind of, different level of consciousness, integral level of consciousness, I guess is what it would call it.
Well, that's what Ken Wilber has moved to recently, is this integral psychology. But I'm not sure how far he's really moved from that original position. My main concern, and people like Rollo May as well, was with this notion of what he called ultimate consciousness. And to me, that is, unfortunately, that polarizes the sense of awe toward just the expansive element. And I think it constricts it because it implies some kind of endpoint. And this is all about the adventure. This is all about keeping it open. Agnosticism, faith in the inscrutable.
It's dualistic as opposed to kind of non-dualism, isn't it?
It is sort of dualistic. And this perspective, our existential spiritual perspective, was much more about an embrace of the enigma of being. So that meant also acknowledging that we have an anxious, fragile, and vulnerable side as human beings, as well as this great capacity to venture out and to expand consciousness. And I think the danger there of emphasizing too much of the expansive is that one becomes presumptuous, potentially imperious. And certainly we've seen that trend with a number of leaders throughout history and even people who have claimed to know the truth with a capital T. So that's a very big concern. Also, the notion that it's limiting, again, isn't it more open to stay, in a sense, to stay in the enigma? Because then it's ever unfolding. It's a stage along life's way, as Kierkegaard would put it.
So it's an ongoing metamorphosis, right?
Something like that. Ultimate consciousness is just another stage on life's way.
We were talking about ontology before. It really does come down to consciousness, though, with awe. And in fact, again, I'm thinking about cosmic consciousness here as we started our conversation.
Back to Buck again.
Yes, Buck and Whitman. I always bring up Whitman.
Oh, because Whitman is just wonderful, and I quote from him pretty copiously.
Let's find out what our listeners have to say. Sasha, our first caller, join us. Hi.
Hi. Well, this has been an amazing conversation. I've really enjoyed it. And
thank
I
you.
Wanted to ask you, what is the best way, or what are some of the ways that you have found to achieve this new sense of understanding and awe when you're in conversation with people? Like, what I have found to get to a deeper level is to reveal something about myself, something sometimes painful or intimate, that creates the ability of other people to do the same. But I wondered what you thought about this.
That creates intimacy. I mean, should we distinguish intimacy from awe, or do we need to distinguish intimacy?
Well, it's all of a piece. Certainly intimacy, for me, is very much a part of the awe sensibility. But I think that the caller has a very good point about self-revelation and how that can help to open the connection with the other and the connection of the other to the bigger picture of life. I do feel that these lenses are helpful. I try to bring these lenses into my work with clients. Let's say if I'm feeling a little stagnated at times, to tune in to the fact again that we are vanishing as we are manifesting, as we are right here. Time is moving by, life is moving by, and that helps me to sharpen and experience the intensity of the moment with that person.
I can also get, and thank you, Sasha. I'm sorry, I feel literally like the devil's advocate here a bit, but I remember John Barth introducing me to a notion early on called cosmopsis, you know, where you just become so overwhelmed by not only transience, but by cosmic wonder and everything that you feel, again, immobilized by it. You feel paralysis set in.
Well, that is, again, that's
a danger. Really,
it's a danger, but I think that would take you away from the awe, which has a natural check of humility in it.
Well, the awe's on the other end of the continuum, really, isn't it?
Yeah. I think so. I think so. And look, it really is important to develop a practice in order to more fully cultivate this sensibility. And that practice, for me, to a great extent, it came out of in-depth psychotherapy in my own life, which I feel was life-saving, and also the mentoring that I had from people like Rollo May and James Bugenthal, and all the immersion in the here and now, in presence, in staying with whatever it was that we were experiencing. All of that is key to what this person was addressing as well, in terms of opening to the radiance of a human relationship.
Let me bring more of our callers on, and we go to Santa Rosa. Randy, join us. Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I asked this question out of respect for your guest, but my problem is, how does this philosophy or psychology help someone who is out of a job, they can't pay their bills, or even in a worse situation, people who are living in poverty? They don't have money for anything. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank
All
you.
Right. Randy, thank you for the question. And the answer is, Kirk Steiner.
Well,
the response is,
I'm glad he brought us down to earth with that question. It's a critical question, especially today. One of the points that I make in the book is that one needs to be able to have bread on the table to be able to subsist at some basic level, generally, to be able to afford the luxury of stepping back, of pausing, and of staying present to the kind of mystery and possibility that I'm addressing here. So, yes, I think, you know, first things first, I mean, people in those situations clearly need to deal with the concrete circumstances that they're challenged by. That said, I still think there are ways that people, even in very dire circumstances, I mean, look at Viktor Frankl in the death camps. Man's Search for Meaning. That was an extremely inspiring book for me on this
me
topic
too.
As well.
Yeah.
Now, if Viktor Frankl and some of his fellow mates could experience the beauty of a sunset through the prison windows at Auschwitz, or even how a ray of light entered into the barrack and reminded him, let's say, of a lovely scene with his wife, the depth of memories and possibilities that almost any moment could open up, if that could happen for somebody like that, think what that could do for someone who is in great despair or depressed, especially if they have a witness who can help them to have a possibility of connecting at that level.
It's very inspiring to think of Frankl in this context. For some reason, my own involuntary association, though, as you speak about Frankel and the death camps, is some of the old-timers will remember the name Henry Morgan, who was an actor and personality. And he used to say, when I have a toothache, it's all I can concentrate on is the toothache. I can't think about, you know, what's going on in the world. I can't think about, you know, possibility of transformation even. I can't have those things enter my consciousness because the toothache kind of really takes over.
You know, what Viktor Frankl did was incredibly admirable and exceptional, I'm sure. But the point is that one can have these experiences. There's the potential there. There's also people like Stephen Hawking, who, you know, was just crippled with ALS, and I believe he was a quadriplegic, and yet was able to tune in to these larger wavelengths in terms of his astrophysics in his case, but seemed to have a life of richness in spite of that condition. So I'm not trying to paint a panacea here or overly romanticize people's despairing situations, but what I'm trying to do is help them notice other possibilities. We so rarely have people who are calling people to notice the more of who they are and the more of their experience. And this is sort of a cry from the wilderness for people to take even a little time to tune in to some of these larger themes and lenses.
Let me I want to go to your emails in just a moment. Let's go to more calls first. Peter in Bodega, hi.
Hi. I was going to tell you about my experiences as a commercial fisherman off the coast here for over 25 years and the awe that it inspires just by being a witness, because you're trying to do something you can't see. But then I was thinking, I used to do a lot of yoga, and here's a trick that works for my awe in watching humans, is standing on your head on the beach, watching people upside down relative to the water, which has become the sky. And that is mind-blowing every time.
All I can say is, wow.
It's a trick.
Yeah, well, actually, I have offered somebody who could stand on their head for that long, I must say.
How people go to the ocean and look and say, oh, whoa, man, thank God.
Well, I'm with you. I mean, nature is one of the greatest access points for the sense of awe, no question about it. And so are, of course, love relationships, relationships with children, etc.
Great art, lest we forget.
Great art, no question about it. But I'm also calling folks to try to expand those usual references to awe-inspiring experiences. I mean, this may sound a little out there, but I am actually attempting to practice experiencing a sense of awe when I go out at night to bring in the garbage cans. I mean, that is possible. How much do we stop and contemplate something like that
behavior? I can relate to that, because when I do that with the garbage cans, I'm often thinking just about the ritual of putting them out there and going through the diurnal and the nocturnal cycles of life and all of that sort of thing. And you're talking about that in your book,
yes.
It seems. In fact,
yes.
Apropos of that, here's a listener named Lila who says, thanks for featuring this discussion. The real difficulty with the topic is that it's a practice and an experiential approach, cultivating openness and humility before the possibility of any moment in time. Trouble is that as soon as we start discussing and intellectualizing, it can be so difficult to preserve that openness. One wants to share that experience to alleviate the pain of the world around, so it's important to talk about. But I've always had the most profound experiences of awe by being in the presence of someone who truly practices this stance of awe as much as possible. Could Mr. Schneider share any of his own tips or from the folks in his book about how to practice this stance, how to stay out of what can be the arrogance and thus frozenness and closure to awe of the intellectual knowing?
It's a great question. Well, there are many paths to the Buddha, as they say, and there are many paths to cultivating a sense of awe, and the people in the book embrace a variety of them. Some found it through being in a library and reading spiritually oriented books, and it started them on a whole new path in that direction. Others through AA and expanding even beyond AA with their thinking and their readings. Others through getting in touch with their ancestry. For example, Jim Hernandez has some very eloquent descriptions of his connection with his Mayan roots and how he brings that to his work with youth as well through drumming and singing. And
these are all kind of spiritual-sounding paths, as you describe them, of course.
These very spiritual-sounding, but again, I think the idea is not to limit ourselves. It's basically about staying as open as one can. And, of course, that's not an easy thing for people to just come around to. That's why I suggest having some kind of practice that can help support that. But in my own case, I actually, a lot of this began to blossom, unfortunately, after a tragic death in my family that really shook our family and shook me to the roots. But I gradually was able to shift from utter terror about life to a place of intrigue and then fascination, along with a healthy dose of apprehension, through a very key therapeutic contact, and actually through my reading and viewing of science fiction stories. The old Outer Limits, One Step Beyond, Twilight Zone. I mean, all of these opening up worlds in very somewhat unsettling but fascinating ways, too.
But it sounds, and this is consistent with what you write about, as if sometimes that opening comes through trauma or through something that is an encounter with terror or anything along those lines.
Especially in our society, because we so quickly close down after we're born in terms of cultural conditioning and fitting into the efficiency model. So, yes, trauma. But let's not forget that we've all had some form of jarring in our lives that we can look to and that could help awaken us.
Jim is our next caller. Jim, join us. Hi.
Hi. There have been a couple of comments about the impermanence of life and the assertion that that leads to accentuation of its enjoyment. I find the impermanence, particularly the deterioration with age and death, to be numbing. And I am far more in awe of people like Ray Kurzweil and some people in the life extension movement who want to cure the deterioration that comes with aging and death. And even those who are willing to have themselves vitrified when they die for the hope that they may be revived. I think that adds to the enjoyment of life. And in a few decades, very long life where we accumulate wisdom without associating that with deterioration will be the norm and the birthright of humanity.
Well, that's a very provocative point. But I have real questions about whether that movement will promote wisdom. Seems to me wisdom is to a large extent about living with questions and living in the uncertain because it implies ever opening, ever evolving. On the other hand, certainly I'm not against helping us with our pain and with our disabilities. But I think there's a risk of going overboard with that. I think this movement is connected with what has been called the transhumanist
movement. That's right.
Movement. Yeah. Where they want to basically develop new new beings through nanotechnology, genetic engineering, and robotics. And I think we need to step back around
too many
this.
James Cameron movies, I think, have affected or infected the imagination here. I wanted to read what some listeners are saying just about experiencing awe. Here's a listener who says, looking at the pictures taken by the refurbished Hubble telescope, the vast expanse of time and space makes us reconsider our own place, and our concepts of religion don't really fit into this scene. Another listener, Robin, writes, last spring I had the most amazing experience to be caught in a painted lady butterfly migration, as thousands of them came over Highway 29 corridor flying north from where they hatched in Mexico. It was like being in a classic Disney movie. We were all dancing in the street as they swirled around us. Such a wonder as we were surrounded by thousands of those delicate but powerful creatures. They were riding the warm winds over the roofs of houses, sailing down into the yard, up over fences, down again, before being lifted up over the next roof, flying like bats out of hell, or heaven in this case. It lasted for several days.
Beautiful.
A good sense of I think what we're talking about is awe here. And you're listening to Forum. We're talking to Kirk Schneider again. His new book is Awakening to Awe. This is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let's go to Capitola. Herbie, morning.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you for the conversation. Right. I have enjoyed so much what you have said. I wanted to talk about finding awe and stepping into a larger context. For instance, when I hear the story of the universe, I feel awed immediately by being inextricably connected to so much. And in a down-to-earth metaphor, I've had a surfing practice for over 40 years. And when I step into liquid, to use a title, it is an unbelievable feeling, and it gets better each and every time. I have words for it, but I resemble Peter's remarks, being in and on the ocean.
Oh, thank you for that.
Well, I love that analogy. I'm actually very fond of body surfing and boogie boarding myself.
And you mentioned science fiction before. Here's a listener who says, I would suggest one of the great drivers of radical openness to radical mystery in today's world is the success of speculative fiction in popular culture. Good science fiction and fantasy are at root thought experiments. They ask, what if? And when you're accustomed to thinking of artificial or alien minds as potential friends, the notion that any human being can be marked off as other seems absurd. Similarly, a mind that can encompass a galactic empire can recognize that you can't throw things away. There is no away, it's all here.
Yes. Well, I think of Einstein's quote, the most beautiful experience one can have is the mysterious.
Another listener, Brian, writes, I don't know whether my personal experience of awe is something I was born with, or whether it came out of study of Eastern thought, or from meditation, or from drug use, or all of the above. Regardless, I'm fascinated by the juxtaposition of this experience with the everyday. Occasionally, I will casually mention something to a friend along the lines of, don't you wonder why anything exists as compared to a vast nothingness? And then, where does this experience arise from? It is one of those questions that cannot be answered, much like a koan, but I can't help but wonder whether it might jolt the consciousness into another dimension.
Good points.
Roger joins us. Hi, Roger.
Yeah, hi. And hi, Kurt.
Hi.
One thing I came across a few days ago in the Chronicle. It was almost like a little poem by Anne Frank, where she said that even though her desperate situation there, I've been to that house in Amsterdam.
Yes.
She could look out the window and see this tree and the branches and the silvery raindrops on it and the blue sky. She was able to capture beauty in the most horrendous condition. And, you know, I want to emphasize something here. I know a lot of your listeners won't agree with this, or it's certainly my truth. I believe there is something outside ourselves, something more powerful than we can command by our own intellect. And it just, in my life, it's come to me. But thank you, Michael.
Thank you for the call, Roger. And Kirk Schneider.
Thank you. Well, it's a great point about how painful circumstances can sometimes lend a poignancy and an intensity to the beauty that is around one. This was brought out in Viktor Frankl's work. I think it's also brought out in European film, in the greatest European films, thinking of Tarkovsky's Solaris, for example, or Kieslowski's Decalogue. I mean, these to me are the great films about the fuller experiences of awe, even more than a film like Avatar, let's say. I hope I don't disappoint too many people there.
William there, from Inverness, I think, is right on point here. Hi, William.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Carl, right? Carl Snyder?
Kirk.
Kirk Snyder?
Yes.
And Michael, yeah, thank you for such a fabulous show today. Should I go ahead
and
speak?
Yeah, tell us what's on your mind.
Okay. Yeah, 3.5 years ago, my wife passed away. She had a brain hemorrhage, and she was in the hospital for 11 days. And the final night of her life, I said my goodbyes to her in the ICU, and went back to my little place where I'd been sleeping next door to the ICU, and I felt this extraordinary force come and take me, and I sensed and perceived it was her, and I had the experience of her taking me as far as she could out to the edge of the veil.
Mm.
And it was the most profound experience of my life, both sad,
yes,
yet extraordinarily awe-inspiring, and it's changed my life ever since. And I have a practice too that I do. But
it's just what you are describing and getting at here, isn't it, Kirk?
I don't think one can come up with a better example of what I'm describing than this caller.
Well, what a way to end. Thank you so much, and again, our sympathies to you on the loss of your wife. And
very much so.
Congratulations to you, Kirk Snyder, on another very provocative book, Awakening to Awe, Personal Stories of Profound Transformation. Again, you can meet the author over at Book Passage. He'll be reading on February the 6th, and his website is kirkjschneider.com. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, and our interns, Jeremy Blackman, David Carini, Julia Jackson, Alexander Park, Mithra Srinivasan. Our engineer is Howie Gelman. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.